humans have been capable of deception for at least as long as we've been capable of speech. There are tips and tricks used by interrogators to get the truth out of people and to know when they're holding out. But when supposed clues like shifted gaze or body language have been tested in a rigorous way, they haven't been all that useful at helping us root out who's lying and who's telling the truth. So, who were the inventors who created what are now usually called polygraph tests, and do they actually deliver on the promise of rooting out false statements? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Rob Rapley is the writer and director of the PBS American Experience documentary, The Lie Detector. It's a fascinating look into the history of using biometric data in pursuit of the truth and into the often uncritical acceptance of the technology to make really important decisions. The film is now streaming at pbs.org, and Rob Rapley is here to tell us about it. Rob, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You open this film with the story of John Larson, who started his career as a police officer in Berkeley, California in 1920. He was maybe, would you say, not a natural fit with the rest of the force?
I would say that's an understatement, yeah. Larson was unique, in fact, in that he was the only policeman in the country with a PhD. He'd written his thesis on fingerprinting, which was then a new area of science, and he was really kind of obsessed about the pursuit of real justice, which was kind of a far cry from the common practice at that time.
So he was ahead of his time in a lot of ways. What was crime solving and crime fighting like in the 1920s?
Well, the United States has had a rather unique kind of setup in that the police were really a branch of the municipal government. And so very much in that era, part of the spoil system and, you know, people's buddies or whatever gang was running the town or the city, you know, right up to a city as large as New York, would be in control of the police. And there was very little science involved. And in terms of, you know, solving crimes, it was really largely a matter of beating somebody up until you got a confession. And that might be the right person or it might not be the right person. But that was an absolutely common practice. And you know, at a distance, we sometimes think, oh, you know, that's kind of quaint, haha, you know, but it really must have been just terrifying, because beating up really, it sounds that was kind of the gentlest form of it, that really it amounted to torture that was practiced very commonly. And that's how they got confessions. Most crimes were solved by confession, and a terrifying number of those confessions were obtained by what was called the third degree. Which, as I say, was kind of essentially torture.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've heard that expression so many times, and I didn't know that there was ever sort of an official set of behaviors around that.
Yeah, the etymology is unclear. There's, you know, there, as often happens, different explanations for it. One was that the notorious chief of the New York City police was named Thomas Byrne. And so the play on words was that you would get, you know, get the burn treatment, get the third degree burns. There are other, you know, accounts for it, that the first degree was the arrest, the second was transportation to the jailhouse or whatever, and the third degree was the interrogation. In any case, it was a widely accepted practice. It wasn't just one region or one city or just big cities, or there were, of course, places that had better police forces than others, but it was accepted by the judicial system as a whole that this was an acceptable way to go about solving crimes. That you know, not until the 1930s did the Supreme Court declare that a confession obtained through violence was inadmissible. So they tried to kind of cover it up a little bit for the sake of appearance, but there was no real downside to doing this. And when you look at mugshots from the period, they really, there's a remarkable number. Obviously some people come into the jail beat up, but it's really a pretty horrifying situation. And it was bad enough that the presidential candidate, President Hoover, in his campaign, you know, kind of promised to clean up the police and put an end to this, and sponsored a very large government report on it. And they went around the country kind of gathering data. And when this was published, it was appalling, even for Americans who'd kind of known that this was going on all the time. But it really kind of ripped the lid off the thing and set change in motion.
Okay, so John Larson's boss in Berkeley at the time, the police chief there, agreed with Larson that humane policy and science were better ways of doing policing than torture. What did he ask John Larson to build for him?
So, yeah, Chief Vollmer, the chief of the Berkeley police, he tasked Larson, this, you know, kind of whiz kid, to build a lie detector, which... it's like, okay, now go about, you individual policemen with no budget, try and, you know, push the frontiers of science. And he did, in fact. It was a remarkable thing that he said about building. It was in the air. It wasn't like it came out of the blue. There were scientists working on this to this end in the United States and overseas. Basically, medical science had progressed to the point that there were devices that could monitor physiological symptoms, and basically by combining those, we have an intuitive understanding that our bodies react differently. Like when you're lying, when you think somebody's lying, they might sweat a little bit, their heart rate might go up, they might breathe a little faster. And so what Larson did was combined several of these relatively new medical monitoring devices into one machine. So to monitor respiration and to monitor pulse, and then a little later to monitor sweat, basically the electrical conductivity of your skin, which changes as you sweat. And so it's not that he invented those devices, but he combined them into one machine that, you know, you could strap a person into these various monitors, including, you know, like a blood pressure cuff, like the kind that we always use. And this device traced the output of those monitors onto basically a scroll of paper, so that you had graphs that are tracking the respiration and heart rate and so on. And his theory was that while no one symptom was conclusive, that if you combine them and you know with experience and a carefully designed questioning technique, that you could in fact fairly reliably spot a lie. And it was a remarkable accomplishment for this guy working with. His only assistant was a high school student working in his spare time, and they borrowed gear from the University at Berkeley, and he came up with really a remarkable scientific achievement.
What was the first real-world case used to test Larson's device?
Well, when the thing was ready for kind of a trial run, Chief Vollmer assigned Larson to solve, you know, a low stakes kind of case, which was a series of thefts from a sorority at Berkeley. Basically this one young woman had a bunch of, you know, jewelry and money stolen from her room. And so Larson brought his machine and installed it at the sorority, and they interviewed each of the young women in turn, and he fairly quickly came up with a suspect, you know, somebody whose symptoms did actually change dramatically when he started questioning her. And through several rounds of questioning, they zeroed in on this young woman until she finally confessed, and she had to quit school and actually left town and went back to Kansas, I believe it was. And this was hailed in the press, as local press, as a real triumph. And certainly Vollmer and their reporters saw this as, you know, this was the future. How amazing is this? We have this device that kind of transcends all of the human failings that could plague an investigation, you know, prejudices and whatever else. The problem was that sometime after the crime had been ostensibly solved, the thefts started up again. And this young woman wrote to Larson from her exile to explain why she had confessed. And it's really a tragic story that this poor young woman had been abused as a child or as a girl, and she hadn't wanted that secret revealed, and so she basically confessed to the crime just in order to make the to avoid that, you know, to avoid that coming up in the questioning. So, you know, this was the first case, and you had, you know, right from the beginning, all the ambiguities were in there.
Yeah, it's so interesting to think that from the very first time it was used, this technology presented some problems. Did that have anything to do with why Larson left the Berkeley Police Department?
I think it was, you know, a cumulative thing that was one obviously kind of disillusioning thing. I think it wasn't so much that the machine hadn't performed perfectly. I mean, that wouldn't be a surprise. You know, this is a radical new invention. So it wouldn't, you know, it's not amazing that it would have not performed perfectly on the first time out. But it was, I think, the consequences, the injustice, and the fact that there was no going back. This young woman's life had been overturned, and the press was, you know, nobody went back to question it. Her name was never publicly cleared. And so I think he foresaw this project really going very badly. And so he not only left Berkeley, he left the police force entirely and decided that he would much rather try to use this new machine as an aid to therapy, really, for psychological psychiatric patients, and that's what he spent his time doing. You know, somewhere where a false result wouldn't have those kinds of consequences.
Right. So he kept tinkering with it, wanted to find a use for it, but did not feel like it was anywhere near sort of ready for prime time in terms of use for proving evidence.
That's exactly right. And he said as much. He wrote that there's no device in its current state that is really, I forget how he put it, but effectively ready for the courtroom or ready to play a deciding role in a conclusive role in an investigation.
So as with many inventions, this technology had kind of parallel inventors working on similar ideas. How did William Marston's deception test compare with Larson's device?
William Marston is a fascinating character. He was a brilliant young man. He went he studied law at Harvard, and while he was there, he took courses with a scientist, Munsterberg, who was investigating. He was working on this deception test idea. And this is early in the century. This actually predates Larson's work. And, you know, Marston, basically, while his teacher was away, came up with this idea that by putting a blood pressure cuff on a person — the blood pressure cuff was a relatively new thing — and actually his girlfriend at the time suggested, oh, you know, your pulse goes up when you lie. And so he set up this test at Harvard and ran these trials and announced to the world that he had effectively a perfect device. He said, you know, that I think out of 100 times, it's been right 97 times, and that the other three, I have an explanation for the other three. So basically, with his blood pressure cuff alone, he said that he'd solved the problem conclusively, and he so that was the beginning of a long road for William Marston and the lie detector.
So Rob, William Marston was less troubled by evidence that the results could not always be trusted than John Larson had. How did Marston start to push for police departments to adopt his invention?
Yeah, Marston, he had no qualms about jumping in and with both feet. And he got involved in a high-profile murder case, a young Black man was accused of murdering a prominent Black physician in Washington. And it's kind of a complicated story, but effectively, you know, Marston comes in, is called in by the guy's lawyers, and he decides that he's actually innocent, that he questions him using his blood pressure cuff lie detector and announces that he is in fact innocent, and he wants to testify to this effect, and that he will, just by doing that, he thinks he's going to convince the judge, and that's going to be the end of it. The judge in the case has other ideas, and he says there's no way that he's going to testify, that this is there may be someday in the future that when this is an acceptable way of solving a case and determining who's telling the truth, but for the time being, that's what the jury is for. And this becomes a cause célèbre, and it's in the papers are following this case with this kind of shiny new scientific device, and it's going to upend the legal system. And unfortunately, Marston loses the case. This young man goes to Leavenworth Prison, spent 18 years there, and for the rest of his life, he, was writing, trying to get a pardon. He insisted that he was innocent, and that, in fact, because of all the uproar about the lie detector and William Marston, that he had stolen the spotlight, and that his defense, which actually, had other valid components to it, had been ignored. It had really just been supplanted by this lie detector business. So he was really kind of collateral damage to Marston's ambitions. And as a result of this, the lie detector has been effectively banned from the courtroom ever since.
Undeterred, William Marston converted his lie detector into something called a love meter.
Yes, he did. William Marston, has all these other adventures going on, but he resurfaces a few years later as a prominent psychologist, in his own, kind of terms. And, what he does is he invites a bunch of reporters to a theater in New York City, where he has three chorus girls, whom he's hired to be tested on his love meter. And so he hooks them up to his device and projects like a love scene from a movie and a murder scene from a movie, and he monitors their reactions. And then I forgot to mention that these three chorus girls, there's a brunette, a blonde, and a redhead. And he draws all these conclusions about the kind of emotional makeup of women with different hair color, which not surprisingly coincide very closely with preconceptions about women with different hair color. And it's there's another kind of added layer of irony to it, because when you watch the film, which we show in the program, it's quite clear that one or more of the young women have dyed their hair, so anyway. So not long on science, but it actually gets him onto the front pages again. He's in a kind of a News of the World thing that's shown in theaters, and that catches the eye of the head of one of the biggest studios in Hollywood. And that kind of opens up, as things always seem to do, it opens up a new opportunity for Marston.
I want to go back to the, I guess, high school intern hired to help John Larson back in Berkeley part-time after school. This guy, too, continued tinkering, right, with Larson's original prototype, first in Berkeley and later in L.A. How did he change the design?
Yeah, so Leonard Keeler, as you mentioned, started off as the assistant to John Larson. And so you have these three very different characters. Larson, the kind of obsessive, rather curmudgeonly advocate of justice. Marston, the kind of huckster, really, the guy who's always kind of looking for the next chance. And then this guy, third character, Keeler, who is above all ambitious. And so he, too, has no qualms about getting involved in real cases. After Larson leaves Berkeley, he effectively inherits Larson's prototype. And he's mechanically gifted and a very, very bright guy, and he does make improvements to it. He's the fellow that introduces the galvanometer, the device that measures the sweat response by measuring the electrical conductivity of a subject's skin. And so he makes it a better machine, a more accurate machine. But he is a little ruthless in how he goes about investigating things. And he realizes that the most effective aspect of this device is that it can induce confessions, that people are scared of it, that they don't, you know, if you can imagine that if you're hooked up to one of these things, we all have secrets, and it's bad enough that they might find out whatever they're looking for, but Lord knows what else they might find out. So it's kind of a terrifying machine, and it's easy to get people to confess with it. And so that's what Keeler really becomes very good at. And he actually explicitly promotes the device in that fashion, that, you know, the most effective aspect of this machine is that it can be used to elicit confessions. And he goes about that first in Los Angeles. And then after 1930 or so, he moves to Chicago, which is, of course, in those days, the capital of American crime.
Yeah, and the city is a mess at the time. What sort of success did Keeler have with his devices in Chicago?
Keeler arrives in Chicago really at the right time. The St. Valentine's Day massacre occurs on, well, St. Valentine's Day in 1929. And in the wake of that crime, even by Chicago standards, that's a pretty appalling thing, and the public is outraged. And in the wake of that, a group of businessmen get together and say, the police are so corrupt, the city's so corrupt, that we need to set up an independent scientific crime lab to try and kind of grab the reins here. And so they do exactly that. They set up this operation that has no connection to the city, no connection to the police. And Keeler happens to show up in town right about this time. And so he's hired as the polygraph, or the lie detector expert for the this new crime lab in Chicago. And so he does several things. He's holding classes, training police officers who come from mostly the Midwest, but all over the country, really, to learn about this new machine. And while he's also working on investigations himself, and he's also kind of freelancing, selling this thing, or selling services rather, to banks and department stores and such, telling employers that, look, I'll test your employees, and you know, we'll see who's honest and who isn't. And even if we catch somebody committing some small offense, you should keep them, because once they've been tested once on this machine, you know, they're never going to do anything again, I promise you. And so that becomes another lucrative kind of branch of his operation. And he has remarkable success. He gets solves a lot of crimes, and probably, you know, jails some innocent people. But he gets an award from the city of Chicago in 1931, I think, for the most significant contribution to the city. And so it's really a remarkable accomplishment for a man who is, you know, not much older than 30 years old.
I have to tell you, Rob, the most remarkable thing to me about Leonard Keeler's approach was how openly he embraced the idea that, look, if it's just the placebo effect, that's okay. The idea that people who believed they could be found lying would not lie, and that was good enough for the test to be shown to work.
That's right. And of course, he had a huge assist in this from the media, because when newspapers reported the many, you know, convictions that he got, this device was always presented as infallible. And, you know, then one of his students, as it turns out, was an unemployed cartoonist who comes up with this new character, Dick Tracy, who becomes kind of the archetype of the scientific cop. It's kind of the forerunner to kind of modern police procedurals that kind of are heavy on technology. And Dick Tracy did more than anyone to popularize the lie detector. It shows up time and again in his comic strips, and then in as other people catch on to the massive success of Dick Tracy, it shows up in other media, and it was always, you know, presented, was always, when you look at the cartoons, it's actually always the latest model of the device. He really stayed in touch with the latest technology, but this all had the effect of increasing the effectiveness of the lie detector in real life, because it, you know, it's kind of a snowball effect, that the more convictions, more press, and then people are ever more intimidated as they get strapped into the thing.
We should talk about subjectivity here, because it seems like the test just spits out answers based on these biological changes that may happen when some people are telling a lie versus telling the truth. But the determinations ultimately, with all of these different devices, have to be made by a human examiner operating the equipment, right?
That's right. It really is not the machine that is coming up with the result. It's the interrogator, the investigator. And this is always the case. Now, I have to say that this isn't junk science, that, it's been studied time and again with varying degrees of authority, but the study that, if we can just jump way ahead for a second, was done in 2003, and most people kind of agree that's the authoritative, you know, the closest thing that we have to an authoritative study, and they found that with a very, very important caveat, that in the right circumstances, with a well-trained examiner, and asking a simple, you know, very carefully framed yes or no question, that the polygraph, is much better than chance. It's not a 50-50 thing. However, the problem is that caveat, that, you know, almost always the certainly in the period that we're discussing, the people had very little training, had every cause to seek a conviction, and were often just kind of questioning, these kind of wandering around in a no particular fashion in their interrogation, and doing kind of surveys of like, oh, have you ever done this? Have you ever done that? And so in that context, which is how it was and still is almost always used, it is pretty useless. But the device is value neutral, right? It's the interrogator that brings the human failing to it. The whole kind of rationale that we look to science to transcend our human failings kinds of in this case and in so many other cases kind of falls apart, because the humans manage to bring our failings to it still.
Can anybody be compelled to take a polygraph test in the United States?
No, not really. I mean, you can, but if you want to, say, work at the border for the Border Patrol, or, everybody who gets that job has to pass a lie detector test. It's still commonly used in the national security sector and by many police departments.
All right, so Keeler is becoming a media star due to the reputation of his test, whether fair or unfair. His wife is into, like, she's made handwriting analysis. John Larson is watching all this and kind of quietly fuming to see his former protege's star rising. Did he act on those resentments?
Larson, yeah, he was more the passive aggressive type. he loathed Larson, but kind of he was so mad he almost said something. He started writing a book that was, or at least he kind of gets the idea of writing a book that's gonna finally expose Keeler's failings and duplicity to the world. So he starts collecting articles and so on, and this becomes a lifelong kind of obsessive project. All this time, he's working in various psychiatric institutions, exploring the kind of therapeutic possibilities of the device, and not really making a ton of headway. But by all accounts, was a great administrator, and you know that in every other way, was a very humane and positive influence on these institutions that in many cases sounded absolutely horrifying in those days. And so he was essentially a really good person, but and was I think genuinely appalled by what was going on with his invention, but he was powerless to stop it effectively, and was deeply frustrated as a result.
Yeah, it sort of quickly spiraled out of his control.
Absolutely, yes. As soon as he walked away from Berkeley, and you know these in a way or more aggressive personalities, Keeler and Marston kind of take over the device.
Rob, I want to go back to talk a little more about William Marston, who was really good at always finding someone to buy into his inventions. He went looking for a market on Madison Avenue, right?
That's right. So he, having left academia behind, you know, the love meter played itself out. And so he starts to sell companies on this idea of using his lie detector in advertising. And to use a specific example, he goes to Gillette and says, okay, well, I will hook up, say, 20 guys to lie detectors, and I'll have them shave with Gillette razor, and I'll measure their physiological symptoms, and then they'll shave with another razor, and I'll measure their physiological symptoms. And not surprisingly, this test demonstrates that men are far more satisfied and happy and fulfilled or whatever when they shave with Gillette razors. And so this seems great. The Gillette likes the idea. And so they want to go national with it, but first they want to just get a second opinion to make sure this is going okay. And so they go to John Larson. And which is kind of a worst case scenario for Marston, because Larson is principled, and Marston actually offers him $30,000 to validate his results, and Larson will have none of it. He actually runs real tests and finds there's absolutely no difference between Gillette razors and other razors. And so this actually goes to the police, it goes to the FBI, and even to J. Edgar Hoover's desk. And there's a memo with J. Edgar Hoover's handwriting in the corner saying, you know, this, I always thought this fellow Marston was a fraud, and this proves it. And so once again, you know, Marston gets away without, you know, going being charged or anything. But once again, he's kind of shown up as something of a fraud, really.
Not to digress too much, but the final chapter of his story, he actually would switch careers again, find real success with this character who wielded a truth-telling device.
It's amazing. Yeah. So after, you know, walking away from one career after another, going through these long periods of having no money. And he and his wife come up with this new comic book character. And it, apparently his wife, Elizabeth, suggested, well, why don't we make it a woman? And so he, Marston hires an artist, and they come up with Wonder Woman, who quickly becomes one of the most successful comic franchises ever. And for people who'd been following his career, they would recognize the lasso of, well, becomes the lasso of truth, which can compel people to do whatever she wants, but increasingly becomes a truth, a way to get the truth from people. And so it's just the, he never managed with real lie detectors, but he sure made a lot of money with this cartoon one.
And boy, love him or hate him, what a truly American figure.
It really is. He's a movie in his own right, for sure. Yeah.
All right, you mentioned J. Edgar Hoover before, and that takes me into the role that these tests played in sort of, I guess, assuaging, but also cultivating fears about espionage during and after World War II.
That's right. The lie detector or polygraph, by this time it's usually known as a polygraph, really comes into its own in the Cold War. There's this pervasive atmosphere of, well, paranoia and suspicion and fear. And it's not like fighting Nazi Germany. The worry is that there are people among us that we can't recognize them, that they're spying, that they're undermining our society, that they're going to steal our secrets. And so we're hunting for people that we can't tell who they are. And that becomes the kind of leitmotif of the whole period. And the lie detector is perfectly suited to kind of ostensibly solving that problem. And it comes to the forefront very early on. You know, the first really, really big trial of the Cold War was the Alger Hiss affair, and which was the first time that this freshman congressman from California, Richard Nixon, comes on the scene. And Nixon effectively sets a trap for Hiss. Hiss, as it turns out, was in fact concealing the truth. And so there's these two men who've accused each other. One of them is lying. So Nixon offers the other guy to in secret, privately, says, will you take a lie detector test? And Hiss's accuser says, yeah, absolutely. And then in public, in front of the cameras, in front of the whole, this was a huge media event, he asks Alger Hiss, who's been accused of being a communist spy, would you take a lie detector test? And Hiss kind of prevaricates and, you know, goes on for pages about his rights and this and that. And it didn't matter. Like, Nixon had already won the battle, that he had undermined Hiss's credibility. And that was kind of part of the end, the beginning of the end for Hiss, and really the beginning of the beginning of the, of this kind of period in the Cold War of kind of trying to ferret out these hidden enemies. And it becomes a favorite tool of the FBI and other kind of national security agencies, hunting out not just communists, but other undesirable elements, as they were called.
Right. They went after gay men working, or people they thought were gay, working in the State Department during the Cold War. Why did people think gay men would pose some kind of security threat?
Well, ostensibly, the idea was that they would be open to blackmail, that they had a secret, and so that the Russians would approach them and say, well, if you don't, you know, give us whatever information we're looking for, that we will expose you. In fact, there was never a single instance of a gay American betraying his country in anything like that fashion. But the fact was, there weren't that many communists to be ferreted out in the State Department in particular, but in other agencies as well. But there were, of course, a lot of gay Americans, and they were all, I think, all hidden, or in and they made far easier targets. It was far easier to find a gay man than it was to find a communist spy. And so they did that for years and years and years through the 70s, I think, and just destroyed hundreds of lives at that, at that time being outed was really not just a terrible social fate, and you change career ending. And so thousands of lives were changed by ferreting out by with a lie detector serving as an aid to exposing gay Americans. It's one of the saddest aspects of the story, really.
How did the history play out, Rob, of private companies using these things to vet their employees, either before they came on board or even after they had been there for some time?
Well, this really takes off in the Cold War. Keeler had kind of started doing this as a side hustle when he was in Chicago with banks and department stores and such. But by the 70s or so, I think more than half of the companies in the U.S. were using lie detectors to kind of investigate their employees. One of my favorite moments in the film, one of the interview subjects tells a story of going with his girlfriend to, she was applying for a summer job at 7-Eleven, and she had to go for the interview, and so he takes her over, and she comes out like an hour later, and she's all upset, and she said, "I failed the lie detector test," and just to serve Slurpees for a summer job, she had to take a lie detector test. And it was that pervasive that it wasn't just national security or the army or whatever. It was everywhere. Millions and millions of tests being run every year. And as you can imagine, I mentioned before that the device actually has some merit when in very, very, very carefully controlled circumstances. But that was not the case, I'm guessing, at that 7-Eleven, wherever it was that, so these really untrained operators are using a very powerful device, and in some cases, really altering people's lives with it. And eventually, the public really gets tired of this. And all along, the media is still—it's really showing up even more and more in the media. And once their cop show, like Dragnet, and these cop shows are on TV and stuff, that the lie detector is incredibly pervasive. It still is. Once you start looking for it, you'll be amazed how often it comes up that some politician will offer to take one, or often it's people, public figures, vowing to take one to prove something or other. And it really is still a factor in our society.
It makes me think about the way that a lot of TV shows now, where crimes are involved, they really exaggerate the ease and accuracy of taking like DNA evidence and instantly, finding someone in a database and proving someone is guilty of a crime. It's forgivable for storytelling purposes, right? You don't want someone, you're not going to document 6 weeks of painstaking work to look over evidence, but we should all be on our guard in terms of believing things just because they're depicted in narrative television.
That's right. In this case, it really, and as it, in the early days, it was one thing. It was one thing for Dick Tracy to pretend that the polygraph was infallible, but it's still portrayed that way. And there've been so many problems associated with it, and it was in fact banned, in business, in the 1980s, and that kind of ended 90% of its use. The use plummeted overnight with that. So it was banned in business because it was so problematic, but still it's always portrayed as infallible, and that it's a good storytelling device because it does kind of, okay, it wraps up with it proves whatever your character was doing, that your character was right and the guy they were tracking was wrong. It does that very efficiently in a story, but it's problematic when you kind of add up the effect of all those images or all those stories.
So you said it's 90% gone. The 10% remaining, I gather, is that government agencies are still allowed to use this on their own employees?
That's right. It's government agencies. Yeah, it was too useful to be discarded entirely. And so especially in the national security sector, everybody working for various agencies has to take one, not just when they apply, but repeatedly. And when there are big investigations, you know, in the wake of 9/11 and so on, it was widely used. It's definitely with us still, and with all the problems. If you go online and search, you know, for how to deal with a polygraph test, you'll find all sorts of agencies saying, "Oh, don't worry, you have to take a polygraph test, but it's fine, you know, and here's what to expect." And because it's not being used as widely, it is, I suspect, being used a little more carefully because it's not just the manager at the 7-Eleven using it, but it's really, really problematic. And there, we should just, I think trust in the end, it's the human who's making the judgment anyway. And so this is just a kind of a mechanical aid to that process.
If I were you working on this film, I would be insatiably curious about the experience of taking a polygraph test. And I wonder if the opportunity was ever available to you to sit for one of these things.
Well, I wish you could see the expression on my 12-year-old son's face when I told him that we were buying a lie detector. Because I own the one that's in the movie. I've never really had the experience because I knew the experience is going into it blind, right? And I've had it put on me, and I haven't been properly questioned or whatever, but that's not the experience. The experience is being intimidated and being uncertain of what's going on and being confronted with this device that you believe to be omniscient, and being afraid that your deepest secrets are going to be revealed. That's the experience. And so I couldn't have that experience anymore.
Rob Rapley is the writer and director of the PBS American Experience documentary, The Lie Detector. It's streaming now at pbs.org. Rob, this has been so interesting. Thanks very much for making time for us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. You can subscribe to our podcast free where you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think, or just listen at our website where you can also sign up for our new newsletter. That is think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.